And joining us on the Book Club on Perspectives this week is Winston Groom. Winston is a best-selling author, award-winning author, most known for Forrest Gump. He is the author of that, and it has taken about 20 years or so to write another novel because he was writing in between writing some other books, historical books. But this book is called El Paso, and it's a very interesting novel, very fun to read, and also has a, you can learn a little bit about history through this novel. But first of all, Winston, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
And also thank you for your years of service, because I know you're a Vietnam vet.
I am. Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about when you got back from Vietnam. Did you decide at that time that you wanted to be a writer, or when did you decide to be a writer?
Well, I thought about being an editor because I'd been the editor of my college humor magazine. And I contacted Dr. Hudson Strode of the University of Alabama, who'd been one of my instructors. He knew everybody. He was a real writer. And he got me interviews with Harold Hayes at Esquire and people at Newsweek and Time and so forth. And they all were very nice and said, well, you don't have the experience to be an editor. And so finally, I asked one of the people that interviewed me, Don Erickson, who later went on to be the editor-in-chief of the New York Times Magazine. I said, what should I do? How do I get this experience if nobody will hire me? And he said, well, I would suggest that you work for a newspaper for a while and just see if you want to be in the business. Just do it for a few years, and it might tell you something. So I lucked into a job at the Washington Star, a newspaper in Washington. And I stayed there for nearly 10 years. And I was a reporter, and I'd had a column, and I'd various things. And finally, I'd been wanting to write a book about Vietnam, a novel. So I did probably the bravest thing of my career and my life. I went in and told the editor I was going to resign to write a book, and which meant that I was, of course, burning my bridges, because if I failed, I would be too embarrassed to go back. And I didn't fail, though. I left, and I went to New York, because Washington is not it's a political town. It's really not a town for novelists. And I went to New York and lived out in the Hamptons, where all the great writers of the day were living, and made friends with them, and wrote my book, and it was, I guess, a success. And I was off and running. I hadn't looked back since.
So tell us about this book, Better Times Than These. Is that the one you're talking about?
That's what I'm talking about, yeah.
Okay, tell us about that book, Winston.
Well, it was probably, if I'd known what I was getting into, I would have never tried it. It was the most ambitious book, except for El Paso, which is another big sprawling story with a lot of people. But what I did was I tried to tell the story of Vietnam by taking more or less the life of a rifle company, which is about 190 people, and followed them around for a year. But I didn't obviously do all the 190 people, but it was a lot of characters. And that's a real hard job when you've done as much writing as I have since. You realize that's a very ambitious project. But somehow I managed to pull it off, and it got big reviews in the New York Times and other places, and did well. I mean, you know, somehow I did it. I don't know how I did it, but I got it done. And after that, I kept on writing books.
We're visiting with Winston Groom. Winston is an award-winning author, historian, and his most popular book, perhaps, which he mentioned, Better Times Than These, and that's a novel about Vietnam. But Forrest Gump is probably the one that most people remember. But he has currently written one now called El Paso. And as you were mentioning earlier, Winston, the fact that you introduced us to a lot of characters, and there are some very lively characters, but perhaps the two main ones, I guess, and correct me if I'm wrong, would be Arthur and his dad?
Yeah, those are made-up people. I mean, that's why some people have referred to this book as an historical novel, which it really isn't. I mean, there's some historical characters in it that I sort of dropped in, some just as cameos, and others I let stay in because they were interesting, like Ambrose Bierce, the old crusty old humorist and
Civil
essayist,
War.
And John Reed, who was a famous socialist journalist who lies buried in the Kremlin with the rest of the communist bigwigs. And so I had sort of I was just going to let them come in and out of the story pretty quickly, but then they got to know each other, and they got to having conversations that I found lively and interesting, so I let them stay. And Tom Mix, the old cowboy star, he was reputed to be riding down there with Pancho Villa. General John Pershing and his aide, then Lieutenant George Patton, were down there. So I let them get in the story, but it's really about the development of those characters, the Shaughnessy family, who own this big sprawling cattle ranch out in the state of Chihuahua, Mexican state of Chihuahua. They're the stars of the show.
You open up Winston. Well, first of all, you open up with Arthur looking out the window and seeing his workers. But also, he has a problem that he has to address. And his father is kind of nonchalant about it. He's off doing his own thing. And then you introduce us to Arthur as a little boy in an orphanage and how he came into the Chosney family. And then from there, you continue to introduce us to the different characters, as you mentioned, Pancho Villa, Tom Mix, Ambrose Bierce, General Carranza, Rodolfo the Butcher Fierro, Henry Flipper, George Patton, General John Blackjack Pershing, who was, again, no stranger to people here in El Paso. And another one of the characters that you introduce us to is Johnny Oya.
Well, yeah, he's... He is the son of the manager of the ranch, but he's also an aspiring bullfighter. And Pancho Villa, who had previously left the Americans alone, there were a lot of wealthy Americans, if I could back up here for just a second, wealthy Americans in northern Mexico at that point who owned a lot of land because the Mexican government had been in such a state of eternal turmoil, it really couldn't provide them the infrastructure. And so they sold off a lot of land to people like the Guggenheims family who established mining, great copper mines and tin mines and gold mines and stuff, and the Harrimans who built the railroad infrastructure, and a number of others, including the Morgan family, who had this big cattle ranch. And I didn't use their name. I used the Shaughnessy. I made it a fictitious. But Johnny's wife was kidnapped by Pancho Villa in this story. He liked to kidnap people and hold them for ransom. And as well, he kidnapped the children of the Shaughnessy family, the two young, a girl who was just turning 13 and a young boy who's 9. And so a good part of the book, and most of the book actually, is a manhunt through the High Sierras to try to get these people back. And there are a number of people who are involved in the manhunt, not just the Shaughnessys, but one of the Shaughnessys' servants is involved. He was responsible for the children, and he's going after them. And Johnny Owens, he leads a group after them. So that Pancho Villa is a hunted man, but he's very dangerous when he's hunted.
We're visiting with award-winning author, historian, novelist Winston Groom. His latest novel is El Paso, and it's a novel featuring the border, the Mexican Revolution, Pancho Villa, as Winston mentioned earlier, Lieutenant George Patton, Henry Flipper, Blackjack Pershing, and a lot of people that people here on the border and in the Southwest will recognize. Now, Winston, for people who may not be familiar with El Paso and Juarez and Chihuahua, was that difficult to describe? You do a very good job of describing the area and the scenery so that people can get a picture of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a historically beautiful area. I've been there a few times, and, you know, it's a part of the country that most people don't. Where I'm from the South. Not that in Chihuahua, I mean El Paso, I think it's further south than I am. But it's just so much different from New England or the Midwest or California. Very starkly different, and intensely interesting.
Let's go a little bit back again. At the beginning, you shared with us about your Vietnam experience, and in a recent interview that you did with NPR, you told them that any experience like that, it's like being in a year-long car wreck. It's traumatic.
Yeah. That's one way to put it. It's not a constant car wreck, obviously, but you don't know what's going to happen, and that the uncertainty of it is as terrifying as the certainty when something does happen. But you know, you get used to it, and I came back, and I don't think I was suffered any bad things from it. I mean, you know, I thought it was. Back then, I went over early on in 1966. I was there middle of 66, the middle of 67. And, you know, we considered it our duty. I was at ROTC in college, and there wasn't any war when I got into ROTC. And when I got out, of course, there was a war. I became an officer, and I did what I thought was expected of me. I tried to anyway. And came back, and that was a bit of a shock. Not so much, I wasn't mistreated like some people felt they were. They'd go to land somewhere, and people would protest and would throw things at them and so on. But just the sort of the shock, and nobody really seemed to care about the situation. I remember walking down the street in town in Mobile, Alabama one day. I was going to see my father in his office, and I ran to an old friend, and he said, "Hey, Grandma, I hadn't seen you in a while. Where have you been?" And I said, "Well, I've been around," and continued on. I didn't feel like getting into it at that point. But that was the kind of thing. It was just a bit of a shock that, not that I expected, you know, some great hero worship, but just that people honestly didn't. The world was functioning perfectly fine while we were all over there doing our thing. And when we came back, it was still functioning.
You wrote a couple more books about Vietnam after the one we just mentioned, but then you wrote penned the novel that people remember because of the movie, and that's Forrest Gump. Tell us about that story.
Well, Forrest was it was kind of crazy. As a matter of fact, I thought that I was crazy to write it. And I finished it, and I was ashamed to show it to my lawyer. I called up a friend. My Willie Morris, Texas writer Willie Morris, who was then teaching writing. He was a writer in residence at Ole Miss. And I asked him, "Do you mind reading it?" And I said, "Just, you know, if you get bored or something after the first page or two, just tell me it's no good." And about a week later, I got a call about, sometime between 2:30 and 3 a.m., which is his desired time to have conversations. And the voice at the other end of the phone said, "Don't change a word of it." And I didn't, and I sent it to my agent, and within a week, he'd sold it to, I guess, Doubleday, and within another week, it sold to Warner Brothers. It was popular, but it was the kind of a book that, I say this, it literally wrote itself. I mean, it's like, came from my lizard brain. A lizard brain is in the back of your neck, and it just went through the regular brain and onto the 10 fingers. It was inspired by a story that my father had told me. He was an old lawyer in Mobile, and my mother had passed away, and I would come back to see him in the wintertime from New York. And one time he began to reminisce. He was born in 1906, and he began to reminisce about growing up in childhood in Mobile. And in his neighborhood, there was a young man who then they called a retarded in those days. And the kids would tease him and chase him and throw sticks at him, and all of a sudden, his mother bought a piano, and the kids watched this piano being loaded into the house. And within a day or so, this beautiful music came out of the house, and the young man had learned how to play these glorious classical pieces. And about the same time as that, 60 Minutes had done a piece on the idiot savant syndrome, which is a case where a person's brain is such that they can hardly tie their own shoelaces, but they can do complex mathematical or musical things. The brain just did one side, only one thing that the brain can do. So I thought after that, I'm going to go back this evening and make some notes, because maybe I can use this as a scene in a book somewhere down the road. But late that night, I had finished the first chapter of Forrest Gump. And I just didn't know. I got his name, and I just every day I'd get up and say, "What's he going to do today?" I didn't have any kind of notes or research or anything. And I was worried about it because it was such a different book, but I kind of figured that if I could get the readers to believe that a perfect idiot could play football for Coach Bear Bryant at the University of Alabama, they'd believe anything.
We're visiting with award-winning author, historian, novelist Winston Groom. He is the author of the book Forrest Gump, but the most recent is El Paso. And El Paso is a novel that features the likes of Pancho Villa, Tom Mix, Ambrose Bierce, General Carranza, Henry Flipper, George Patton, John Blackjack Pershing, and John Reed, among others. Now, in this novel, as we were discussing earlier, Winston, you kind of threw us into a lot of historical sites, places, and also we meet a lot of people, as I just mentioned. You did the same thing in Forrest Gump. Tell us how that idea came to you.
Well, I'll be honest with you, I didn't think about that at all. I mean, when I was writing El Paso, I didn't think about Gump. It never occurred to me, although it occurs to me now that you remind me, and somebody else had made that comparison, that Forrest meets a lot of people, historical people, but actually in the book that I wrote, he meets a lot of more people than just the ones that were in the movie. Who were not historical people. And the same is true, I think, with El Paso. The main characters are fictional. They're made up. I'm interested in is getting into their brains and not dropping a whole bunch of historical names out there just for the heck of it. But I also might mention this, that El Paso is setting is 1916, which is coincidentally 100 years ago this year. That's when the novel set. I think we hadn't gotten around to saying that, so that's the time frame that I'm talking about. It and what happens is that Pancho Villa, he had, as I said, left the Americans alone until President Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, recognized his arch enemy as the legitimate leader in Mexico. It stopped him from using El Paso to get his arms and ammunition and other supplies for his army, and so he turned on the Americans, and in particular he turned on, in my story, the big cattle rancher, the Shaughnessy's own, to feed his army. He was rustling cows. And then went there and did some kidnapping. And so the rest of the story is, you know, the attempt by the Shaughnessy family and others to get their loved ones back. And there's a lot of danger out there. There's a lot of danger on the trail from wildlife and the weather from Pancho Villa, who is reputed to have won a bet that he couldn't shoot the eye out of a man who was sitting on the veranda next to his wife with his pistol. And he won the bet, and then feeling remorse, he went and gave the proceeds of the bet, which I think was something like 10 or 15 pesos, to the widow. He was that kind of a fellow.
Tell us, a lot of novelists will keep on writing novels, continuing, but you took a break after Forrest Gump. You took a break, not from writing, because you wrote several historical books and very awesome books about the Civil War, about World War II, about, oh my gosh, I forgot the name of the other book, because you wrote several, but you dedicate El Paso is to your daughter, I guess, is when you were writing and you tell her about what you were writing back then?
Well, yeah. She's 18 years old now. She's a freshman in college, but she used to come into my office and I'd be working on something and she'd ask me, she was seven, and she'd ask, what you working on? And I'd say, well, I'm writing a story for you. And it's about cowboys and Indians and the Wild West, whatever it was. And so I dedicated this last one to her. And I was proud of her for just being who she is. She's a terrific girl, very beautiful girl, and very smart and very nice. But after Forrest Gump, it occurred to me that a lot of novelists, and there's always exceptions, like Dickens or somebody, but a lot of American novelists, the problem with novelists is not that the writing so much as the ideas. And a lot of times you just run out of ideas for a good book, but these novels, some of them keep on writing even though they don't have any good ideas. And it's not that they're not good writers, but the books are no good. And then it wind up, the public gets down on them, and the critics get down on them, and the publisher gets down on them, and the agents get down on them. And you wind up like Scott Fitzgerald and Thomas Wolfe, drinking himself to death at an early age, or Hemingway, you know, blew his brains out. And that was not a path that I particularly wanted to go down, and so I thought I always liked history, and I thought I could write history, and I guess I've done about 8 or 9 books of history.
And one of the books I failed to mention is The Generals, and of course you talk about the generals who were on the front lines and behind the front line during World War II, and that includes General Patton, MacArthur, and another general who is well-known to El Paso, and that is Omar Bradley, who was stationed here at Fort Bliss as well.
Yeah, General Marshall.
Yes.
George Marshall. He spent most of the Second World War trying to keep the other two from imploding. He didn't like either one of them, but he sort of knew better for the country if they were fighters, and he would better keep them. I know because General Eisenhower certainly wanted to fire General Patton at it several times, and a lot of other people wanted to fire General MacArthur, but because they were difficult people, but they could get the fighting part of it done. And yeah, General Marshall was down there in Texas. God, he said he was the hardest job he ever had in the Army. He had to, just him and one other guy, a sergeant or something, had to survey an enormous amount of territory in Texas with just the two of them. And in the heat of the summer, I remember that part. So I sort of knew about a lot about that part of Texas from that General Marshall story.
We're visiting with award-winning novelist, author, historian Winston Groom. His latest novel is El Paso, and it's a novel that features Pancho Villa, Tom Mix, Ambrose Bierce, General Carranza, General Rodolfo the Butcher Fierro, General John Blackjack Pershing, among others. And it's basically a book that involves a father-son team that owns a railroad company, but some other things happen in there. Now, with your historical background as an historian, Winston, did you decide beforehand as far as like, let's get back to, how did you decide that El Paso was going to take place the way it does in the book?
Well, it came to me at first through a collection of stories that a friend of mine told me, Edward Morgan, who is no longer with us, and he was a New York Morgan. I think J.P. Morgan was his great uncle or something. But they were a different branch of the family. His great grandfather was the governor of New York, and they had big financial companies. And anyway, they had this ranch down in the state of Chihuahua. It was well over a million acres, and they had a great many cows on it, and Eddie would take me to lunch or whatever, and tell me these great old stories that he had heard from his uncles, who would go down with, they were the sons of the owner, and would go down in a private railroad car every year. So what I had to begin with were just this collection of stories, which does not a novel make. Just a bunch of good stories. You really have to get a theme. And I tried, and I never, for 20 years I had those stories there, and I never could quite put it together the way I wanted it. And finally, a couple of years ago, I just took a year off, and I said, I'm going to pull this thing together and, get some good, just something besides just some good scenes. I wanted to get some characters in there who had real grit and that I thought that the reader would enjoy hearing about. And so that's what it takes when you do a novel like this. You got the dressing, but you don't have the lettuce and tomatoes. You got to get the lettuce and tomatoes first. I did all that and made me a salad, and I hope it tastes good.
One of the interesting characters, well, I found him interesting, is Arthur's friend at the orphanage, who later steps up, becomes a lawyer, but he also helps Arthur in some tough situations.
Yeah, he was a tough character, and I don't want to give away a lot in the book, but
no.
he's actually a good guy and he's a bad guy, and we see both of that in the story. And in my first imaginings of it, he was just a good guy. But then I made him a bad guy, too, and I think that fleshed him out. And it gave the story a strong theme. But that, when you're dealing with all these characters and you own them, I mean, they're yours. They will do what you tell them to do. And you have to be real careful and make sure you're not writing about yourself, because there'll come a time. I mean, James Jones taught me that. He's the guy who wrote From Here to Eternity. He was a good friend of mine. And he said, don't write any kind of biographical thing here, autobiographical. He said, because if you do, make it like yourself, there'll come a time when that character's got to do something she wouldn't do, and then you're going to be stuck. And so I try not to do that. But in the case of Mick Martin, the name of the character you're referring to, I had him do some bad things.
Winston, tell me a little bit about, at the beginning of the interview, you talked about how you told us this is not a historical novel. It does have some historical characters from the 1916, 100 years ago. Tell me a little bit about when you write something like this, how careful do you have to be? Because you know you're going to be criticized by historians or other people who say, well, that's not the way it happened, or this character was not there. But by doing what you did, you make it very entertaining.
Well, that's what I'm there for. I mean, it's a novel. It's fiction. It's made up. That's what novels are. And I don't give a damn someone's criticize me. I mean, I most of those characters were, in fact, there. At least by some of my researchers, I couldn't ever get any definite proof that Tom Mix was there, but he was certainly rumored to have ridden with Bunch over here, and it's too late to ask him. I think that, you know, I just drop them in there and you know, sort of see what happens. And I know that John Reed was in fact there. The newspaper stories that he wrote came out of there, and we know that Ambrose Bierce went down there in 1913, and nobody knows what happened to him. He wouldn't have gone down there the way I described it in the book, but well, that's why I call it a novel. You get certain license to be artistic or change some things. And I said somewhere up front that I've tampered with the evidence in some cases to suit my storyline. I mean, you know, if you want to read history, there's plenty of good history about that period. As a matter of fact, I have listed it in the preface or foreword or whatever I said in the book. And I think at the end, too, I listed some of the better books about it. But this is just a tale that, you know, a tale that's told. And I had all these stories, and I thought this was way back 20 years ago. I thought, you know, this could make a good novel. How am I going to get around to it? And I worked on it, and I never could get it right. And then finally, a couple of years ago, I did. And here it is, brother God and everybody.
And Winston, we are glad you did, and thank you so much for taking the time to spend with us and talk a little bit about not just El Paso, but also your other books and your career. And we are very grateful that you kept those characters in your brain for 20-plus years.
Hey, man, I think you find it novelists only like they'd love to talk about themselves. It's a stock and trade.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me on. Seriously, I've enjoyed it very much, and you asked some interesting questions, and hope we'll do it again sometime.
Thank you, Winston. We've been visiting with Winston Groom. He is the author of the novel El Paso. You can find out more about Winston by going to Winston Groom, and you can find out a little bit more about the book. And what is your web page?
It's just my name, Winston Groom, winstongroom.com.
Thank you so much, Winston. You have a great day, okay?
You too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Felipe Talavera. Our producer is Dennis Wu.